the sexual revolution has hurt women. And you don't need to look at a Christian or value-based research for that. This is just sociological. Even some feminist sources are looking around saying, this has not produced the women's liberation that we thought it would.
Welcome to Christ and Culture, the podcast of the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here we'll explore how the Christian faith intersects all avenues of today's culture through conversations with leading thinkers. Welcome to the conversation.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Christ in Culture. I'm Nathaniel Williams, the editor and content manager here at the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture. Today's episode will be a little bit different. Dr. Benjamin Quinn and Megan Dickerson talk with Dr. Katie McCoy about gender, female and male identities, and how to navigate all of these questions in an increasingly confused culture. The conversation went a little long, but honestly, it was too good to cut short. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually skip the headline segment today to get right into the meat of the conversation. After that, we will have another edition of our segment On My Bookshelf. But before we get to our Christ and Culture conversation, one gentle reminder. Stop what you're doing, go to your favorite podcast platform of choice, whether that's Apple Podcast or Spotify. Go ahead and give us a 5-star rating, brief review, or just a question or a comment in there. It really goes a long way to helping us spread the word about the Christ and Culture podcast and also know kind of what you're thinking and how you're interacting with it. So go ahead and do that. And now we're going to jump into our Christ and Culture conversation.
What does it mean to be a woman, and why does it matter for Christians? Here to help us answer this question today is Katie McCoy. Dr. Katie McCoy, in fact, holds a PhD from Southwestern Seminary, where she was on faculty for a number of years, and currently is the Director of Women's Ministry at the Texas Baptist General Convention of Texas. She's also the author of a book, this is what we're going to talk about today, called To Be a Woman: The Confusion Over Female Identity and How Christians Can Respond. Katie, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I should also mention that joining me as well as a co-interviewer is our very own Megan Dickerson. Megan, who works with us here at the Center for Faith and Culture as our grant administrator. Megan, thanks for assisting us in this conversation.
Yeah, always glad to be here.
Let me just jump straight in. Katie, if you will, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I've been at this role in a state convention since, summer of 2022, I think. 2021. It's all running together. And I'm getting to take a lot of what I did in the classroom and adapt it for women in the church. So it's very fun to get to create training opportunities and different resources, especially connecting women to a lot of theological training that they're interested in. They just don't know how to create for themselves. And so we're bringing it to them where they are.
So working for the Texas Baptist Convention or the Baptist General Convention of Texas, what does this look like on a day-to-day basis? When you were a seminary professor, I can imagine what that's like on a day-to-day basis, but what's sort of day-to-day for your responsibilities now?
No 2 weeks are the same. And so some weeks are project heavy. Some weeks I'm out speaking. Some weeks I'm doing writing projects. Some weeks I'm doing podcasts like this. And sometimes it's just a little bit of all of it. So there are really no 2 weeks that are the same.
Awesome. All right, let's talk about the book. So the title of it again is To Be a Woman, published by B&H Academic, I believe. And this book has gotten quite a lot of attention lately. I'm seeing it all over the place, hearing about it all over the place. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah, so it really came out of that opportunity where preparation meets need. And I was talking to an editor at Lifeway, and I said, well, I could write on this topic related to all this gender confusion. And she said, well, there's a big need for that. And I said, well, I'll do it if you're my editor. And so she agreed. And I thought that because I had taught on this topic several years ago and had been developing it since then, I thought I would really have a lot in my arsenal. And the truth is, I had about a pinky finger's worth of research when I really got into all the material, because it was vast. It reaches many different aspects of our society, and it's just really taken over a generation like a tidal wave. And so I've been amazed at a lot of the response, in part because, and it shouldn't surprise me by now, but whether you're in a big metroplex or a rural town, this issue is reaching especially young women. Wherever there's social media, there's gender confusion somewhere among Gen Z, Gen Alpha coming right behind them, because in part it's been so proliferated by social media and pop culture.
Megan, I know you have questions about the history and the cultural analysis. I'll hand it over to you for our next question.
Yeah, I guess first, my husband was a youth pastor in rural Arkansas, and we dealt with these same questions, and it felt out of nowhere. Because we were in the middle of no, you know, like we're not connected to a big town. This is, you know, and so I'm just really thankful for you raising the awareness of these questions. And because it's such a part of our society, you go through a lot of the historical and cultural analysis. Why do you include so much of that? Why do Christians need to understand where things are coming from?
This did not happen in a vacuum. This is the result of decades of cultural thought and percolated value systems that have really bubbled over into the cultural moment that we're in right now. And if we just drop ourselves into the conversation and have try to have, whether it's a worldview type conversation or even just a common sense conversation with someone who is a product of these cultural ideas, we're going to feel like we're talking in a different language. Many times, because we are quite literally using similar terms with completely different definitions. And so, if we are to have an effective witness to this next generation coming up, we have to know not only what they are exploring related to all of these gender questions, but why they consider it so important and what are the foundations or the ingredients, so to speak, in how they are making those self-assessments.
If you were to pick one or two that most people aren't aware of, what might be a couple things that people should go and think about?
One, you might have heard this term, expressive individualism. And Carl Truman, in his book Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and then the condensed version of that, Strange New World, he goes into a lot of expressive individualism and its effect on the modern cultural psyche. And it's effectively, you could sum it all up in the three-word mantras: you do you, follow your heart, live your truth. We hear these things all throughout our society. They're praised, they're valorized, and the core idea behind them says, you know who you are. No one has the authority to contradict who you are. Not even your own physical body. And so expressive individualism is something that has taken hold of not only this younger generation, but it's been around for quite a while. We're just now seeing it collide and be absorbed by the messages related to SOGI, sexual orientation and gender identity. The next one can sound a little bit like Henny Penny, the sky is falling. And so it's important to note this is coming from a documented historical perspective. But the correlation between critical theory, specifically critical gender theory, and ideological Marxism writ large in society, you can draw a straight line. So much of true gender ideology that we're hearing advanced in the halls of higher education, certain policy initiatives, if people are being really honest, they will acknowledge their affinity for the ideas of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, and then after them, Wilhelm Reich. The idea being that all of society can be reduced to a conflict, and we just have to figure out who are the categories that are in conflict, displacing the majority, and then anything that would aid or abet that majority. The way that's working out now is that if you are a Christian, if you are white, if you are straight, if you are called cisgendered, which is a made-up word meaning that your sense of self aligns with your biological sex, all of these things essentially create the problem person of society, because that person not only is the majority, but is essentially calling the shots in society to protect their own social power. So as a result, we hear language like decentering the majority in the name of resistance or in the name of social justice. It's important to note as well, all of those things, they're trying to create what they believe is a more just and right world. But when you do that, when you go for ideas like justice and righteousness and equality, or you might hear more the word equity, when you do that and you have no sense of transcendent truth, no overarching principles, and certainly no personal God to whom you are accountable. Take all of that away, and the only thing that is left is the dynamics of social power. And that's what we're seeing happening today, writ large. So when you think about, for instance, intersectionality and the effects that it's having on society, it moves away from the descriptive of how different people with different demographic categories have different experiences. And it moves to prescriptive by saying, therefore, here's how we create a more just and equitable society. We decenter the majority, elevate the minority, and the minority not only is worthy of attention, but they are a more trustworthy source of truth. All of this is funneling into the gender conversation. Because now, when you have people talking about laws and policies to protect trans kids, for instance, these are not just gender arguments. They are political arguments. They are arguments about the relationship between the individual and society, the individual and family, and especially family rights. All of this is culminating to the moment that we're in. And again, if we're not aware of the ideas that are creating it, we have no hope of being able to offer a counter-formational vision for what it means to be a human being.
Okay, when you talk about that, you use the language of that when those kind of phenomenon emerge, that we hand over cultural power to, I guess, to those communities or at least to those ideologies. Well, so when that happens, then what happens to the definition and identity of self or the definition of self? At that point, then, are we still self-defining, or is that a different example of an ingredient, as you talk about in the center of your book? Or have we just handed it over to the minority to divide at that point, or to government to define, or society at large? Is it crowdsourced identity determination at that point? How do you answer that?
That's a great question. In fact, I think one of the ways that on this side of it, I think we can look as a corrective. One of the ways that Christians attempted to enter into those conversations that were happening 10, 15 years ago was essentially to co-opt the terms that culture was using and baptize them in Christian theology. That has not worked. In part because we are using definitions very differently than the world using them. So, for instance, even ideas like justice. Well, we can be using that term, and we're talking about a biblical theology of justice based on transcendent truth that is given to us by a righteous and holy God. And we understand that value system through his word. When our culture uses ideas like social justice, that comes with a lot of political baggage. And one of the ways that we have done a disservice to our witness is by trying to somehow make those coincide. We need to recapture and recover the biblical definitions of God's character attributes, and therefore who we are called to be, how we are to emulate those attributes in society. Because if we don't, and I love how you said this, handing it over to society, handing it over to culture as though culture gets to define what is good, and we are adapting our definitions and our Christian practice in light of it. In fact, I think that we talk a lot about how every generation we have to be mindful of the pulls towards legalism and the pulls towards liberalism. And I'll never forget my theological mentor, my doctoral supervisor, Malcolm Yarnell at Southwestern Seminary. He said, the essence of liberal theology is to allow culture to set the questions and then adapt our Christian theology around those questions. So I think one thing it's going to be this difference between taking on the definitions that culture is using and subtly but clearly approaching it the way Paul did at Mars Hill to not adapt but to enter into, to say, I see that you are concerned about a just society. That is a good thing to be concerned about. Here's where the practice of a world that has ejected the reality of a personal God is going to lead us. And here is why we need an overarching principle given to us by a transcendent God to guide us in those things. That's a bit abstract for what you're talking about related
No,
to
that's helpful though,
the
because
same
it's
thing.
I think you're right in that it puts the onus on us, and I think a very honorable way to recognize the virtue of a vocabulary among certain conversations, but then also say in a roundabout but also neighbor honoring way, what you mean by justice and what I mean by justice. Let me make sure that we're clear on those things, and let's identify the differences, but then let's also celebrate the commonalities. And I think that's beautiful, and that's exactly, especially as it relates to definitions of self and identity and those kind of things, where we need to be more clear than on these kinds of things, and to make sure these are incredibly important conversations. There are sometimes that we're using same words and totally different meanings.
Exactly.
And we have to be careful not to give over the kind of definitive authority to culture or to various common groups of whatever sort. So that's incredibly helpful. I wanted to highlight in the middle of your book, the chapter, this is chapter two, the ideas that dominate our sense of self. And Megan was signaling to these. I just wanted to read a few of these because so often, I think us as teachers, academics, pastors, whatever the case is, we throw out labels that may not always connect with our audience. And I'm thinking about my 17-year-old daughter for a second. If I were to just use the word postmodernism, she might nod, but she really doesn't know what I'm talking about. You know, she's heard it, but she does. But what you have right beside that is, let me give you an example of what that means. It's the if it works idea, if it works for you idea. And then she's like, oh, I know exactly what that is. Oh, I hear that all the time. I may even practice that all the time. Or another one is post-Christianity. And she might think, not really sure what you mean by that. Well, it's this notion of a kingdom without a king, or you, as you said, expressive individualism. She would just nod in agreement. But if I said, you know, the whole live your truth mentality, oh, she knows exactly what that is because she has furries in her classroom that are doing that very thing every day,
Oh
right?
my word.
So I simply wanted to highlight this for our listeners. One of many reasons to get this book is because of how you take sometimes these labels that we use and that we're trafficking in, but you break them down in very accessible ways. For men, women, boys, girls alike. I just find that incredibly helpful.
Thank you so much. That is the whole point of the book, so thank you.
I want to ask you about this. So I know this is maybe a little bit of a turn in the conversation, but I'm curious. We've heard so much in the last couple of years about another one of these labels, toxic masculinity. And I suppose there's multiple things that that may mean, but not less than a certain expression of masculinity or malehood that's kind of dominating, heavy-handed, patriarchal, all of these kind of vicious types of ideas. I'm curious if there is, and if so, what is a parallel to that from a female perspective? Is there such a thing as toxic femininity?
That's a fascinating question, and frankly, not where I thought you were going to go with it. Because when you start talking about toxic masculinity, I'm thinking, okay, Nancy Piercy's book or the reactionary culture of post-sexual revolution and the crisis of men and boys, and then you've got, Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate and all these men that are giving some type of vision of what it means to be a man, and you have this undiscipled, fatherless generation looking for that. I think the best corollary that I could think of, I don't, this is going to come out kind of awkward, but it's the woman who believes that she can be, forgive me for your listeners, but the empowered porn star. Because the woman who is aggressive not only in her sexuality, but believes that expressing that is a form of social power, and that there any attempt to curb that or channel that into a family life, is considered oppressive, regressive. And so you have, oh, I mean, just look at the pop culture icons today that are dominating, let's say, top 40. You've got like Nicki Minaj, Beyonce. You could go down the list, even some things Taylor Swift, and it's just this idea that an empowered woman is a woman who sexualizes herself to become the object of men's fantasies, and she calls it liberation. And one of the things that we're seeing as sort of a backlash of that too, I think about backlashes related to how the sexual revolution has hurt women, and you don't need to look at a Christian or value-based research for that. This is just sociological. Even some feminist sources are looking around saying this has not produced the women's liberation that we thought it would. And now you have women looking around saying, I'm 30, 35, 40. I want to be married. I want to have kids. And yet I'm living in a society that is almost antithetical to that and shames me for wanting it. And so you've got some interesting pendulum swings. And a few that come to mind are the rise of the trad wife. That's an interesting pendulum swing of women who essentially want the exact type of life that their mothers would have been running away from in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then you've also got things like outlets. Evie Magazine is one that comes to mind. It's not Christian, it's not necessarily religious, it's traditional femininity given in a mass readership type of language. And so, really interesting moment that we're in. I think we're seeing the failures of the sexual revolution, the failures of second and third wave feminism. And you have a generation of both men and women who essentially want everything that God designed us to want in terms of partner commitment, family life, stability. And I would even say that you have a generation of women who are doubling down on their careers, not only as a fallback in the event that they get divorced, but when you have a woman in her, I say this as a 39-year-old, but you have a woman who is a career woman. I wouldn't consider myself a career woman, I'm in ministry, but you have a career woman who is looking at her 40s and 50s. She does not have the built-in priorities that a wife and mother has. And a generation ago, that would sound like something out of Phyllis Schlafly, something just derided as regressive for women's rights. But now, on the other side of feminism, on the other side of the sexual revolution, you have a generation that is trying to define themselves not in terms of family, not in terms of faith, and then what's left. They're organizing themselves according to largely identity politics, and Mary Eberstadt has done a lot of work and research on that. So I think that's the corollary to the toxic masculinity, and I think there is a generation of girls coming up that they want whatever that is not.
Before Megan, I want to give you the next question here in just a second, but before we do that, Katie, if you were to boil it down then and just say, okay, here are the fundamentals, the Christian biblical fundamentals of femininity, the unique and distinctive markers of what it means to be a woman. And I'm imagining this conversation with my 17-year-old daughter, who I think would say, hey, look, the whole transgender sexual identity rage, it's all around me. But I think she would say, I'm not fighting that so much as I'm fighting. I just want to know what it means to be a Christian woman. So what are those fundamentals? How would you answer that?
Such a great question. First, when you mentioned the transgender ideology, so much of it boils down to feelings and stereotypes. In fact, when you decouple feminine identity from a female biology, that's all that you're left with is feelings and stereotypes. So whatever it is to be a woman in God's image, it has to be more than feelings and stereotypes. So I have furrowed some brows and stepped on some toes with this definition of biblical womanhood, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. I
Go
really
for
believe
it.
a biblical woman is a female created in God's image, reconciled to God in Christ, who desires and patterns her life according to all of God's ways and word in her life and relationships. Now, you might listen to that and think, well, you could just replace male with female or female with male and then feminine pronouns with masculine pronouns and have the same definition. And to that, I say, exactly. That's exactly the case. Because when you factor in the complexity of what it is to be embodied male or female, the ingrained neurologically based differences between male and female, I believe that when you have a woman who is following God in all of her life and relationships, patterning her life according to his word and his ways, you are going to have a woman who fulfills biblical womanhood. She is going to express that discipleship in her marriage, in her ministry, in her local church, in her relationship to society, in her priorities, in her personal virtue. And that also helps protect us, by the way, from the false categorization of making some virtues gendered.
For instance, a woman
can be bold and courageous. She should be. Deborah. Abigail, bold and courageous. A man can be gentle and kind. He should be. It's a part of the fruit of the Spirit. Jesus, gentle, kind, right? So the existence of virtue is not gendered, but I do believe the expression of those virtues can be influenced by not only our gender identity, but also the biological differences between male and female, how we communicate, how we relate, how we express ourselves. And so I guess what I'm saying is, I think we make it way too hard. I think if we focused on being disciples of Christ and actually following all of God's commands to us, where they are different for men and women, and then, of course, where they are identical, I think we will have both biblical manhood and biblical womanhood without having to reduce it to some one definition that inevitably someone doesn't fit, without having to negate the differences and the personality temperaments that God has given us. But in a way, I think that's even more powerful, because now it's not something that is that's something to my personality. Like, I don't have some type of attribute that is expected of all women. Rather, I am patterning my life. I am allowing my life and sense of self-perception to be formed by someone else. And as I am following that someone else, Christ, he develops, the Holy Spirit disciplines, forms, shapes who I am as a female created in his image. So really, if I could boil it down to anything, it's follow Christ and his word and ways in all of your life and relationships. And where that's different for men and women, apply it differently for men and women, and then live your life, let the Holy Spirit work from the inside out to express what he meant by maleness or femaleness. And I think it's that simple.
That's good. Even in my own work, I love to emphasize the language of the way of Christ. And if exactly as you're saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if we pattern our lives as men and women according to the ways of Christ, then it sure seems like these natural and proper expressions of malehood and femalehood will manifest themselves as God desires in our bodies. In these ways. I love the language, live your life. That's great. Megan, I've gotten in your way too much. Go ahead.
No, I appreciate it. And just in my life, like, I'm really bad at decorating my home. Like, I'm just really bad at it. Always have been. It's just how my brain works. I don't picture things well. And so decorating my home has always been a struggle for me. And that has at times, especially in the church, when we come and do floral arrangements as like, this is our women's ministry activity. I see. Or I've grown up around places of the church where that is what it means to be a woman, is to have a beautiful home or to. And so there have been moments where I've felt like less of a woman because of those kinds of things and those stereotypes. And so you just saying all of that, or we have, friends and people that we love that don't fit the model of manhood, that they don't want to go and hunt in the woods. They don't want to go and play football. He's not that kind of guy. And so then he doesn't know what to do with himself. And this younger generation just assumes, because of all that you've already said, that, oh, well, I'm not the gender that I was born into.
Exactly.
And so breaking out of those stereotypes, like you just said, and we get to just live our lives. We get to love the things that God has put in us to love. We get to live out our lives in the way that the Lord has given us.
Yes, that's so good. That's so good. It's important to remember the best artists and chefs in history are men. The person who figured out how to send a man to the moon was a woman. One of the greatest prime ministers in British history was a woman. And so when you try to reduce it to attributes like that, it does a disservice really to all of humanity. That but see, all of those attributes or interests can still remain, and a man can be masculine and a woman can be feminine. It's not something that is external. It's something that is from the inside out.
I love
All
that.
right. So there's a lot to be afraid of. Like, there's a lot of things culturally. The water that we swim in is a little bit scary right now. So how do we keep from living out of fear?
Oh, that's a great question. First, the promise in 2 Peter 1 that the Holy Spirit's promises has given us everything we need for life and godliness. And that includes how to be faithful disciples in this moment. So, no, we don't need to live out of fear. We do, however, need to live with discernment. And I would say that especially for parents of little ones, to get very inquisitive about things that are said and taught in your child's school. Very inquisitive about social media, smartphones, children's entertainment and education. So it doesn't need to be out of fear, but we do need to be vigilant about the ideas that we are allowing to influence not only our families, but ourselves.
It's a good word.
Katie, in terms of parting words here, give me 20 seconds to 30 seconds talking to young girls and just say, here's what I want to leave you with. And then give me 20 or 30 seconds to young boys and say, here's what I want to leave you with about what a woman really is.
To young women, God formed you beginning in the 8th week in your mother's womb, since before she even knew she was expecting you, formed you in a specific way to create a machine that is built for connection. That's not a theological statement. That is something from secular neurophysicists who are secular neuropsychiatrists who are looking at the complexity of the female brain. Because of that, you are wired not only for empathy to identify with and care for others, but you are wired to absorb the feelings of others. And unless that is guided by the Spirit of God, it can be manipulated by a culture to cause you to identify with feelings that are going to lead you in a wrong direction, and to magnify feelings that are just the symptoms of other issues. Who you are as a woman, you will never make sense of that apart from a right relationship with your creator. Now, to young men, for them to understand that from the very beginning, God created women to complement or fit men. And not only is that true physiologically, but the physiological is a external manifestation of the spiritual, the emotional, and the intellectual. There's a reason that God did not create the first woman out of the dust of the ground the way that he created the man. He was making a point to us. He was telling us that she is of the same stuff as he is. And the only way that he could disparage her intellectually or as a person would be to disparage himself. The only way that he could disrespect her would be to disrespect himself. And we even see that reiterated in Ephesians 5, what Paul says to husbands. husbands and wives. And so I think both the complexity, not only of who we are as individuals, but the complexity of who God created us to be as an analogy of relationship is what Karl Barth said, between male and female, is itself a story that we are telling with all of our lives.
Katie, this is fantastic. We need another 30 or 40 minutes, but Nathaniel's going to fire us all. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Katie McCoy. She's written a book called To Be a Woman, The Confusion Over Female Identity and How Christians Respond with B&H Publishing. Katie, tell us where our readers or our listeners can find your book and how they can follow your work.
Best place to get it is on Amazon. You can find the Kindle version, the print version, and then the audiobook version, which I got to record myself.
And what about social media? Can they follow you there?
Social media, yes. Blonde Orthodoxy, blonde with an E. Just Google that and you'll find me.
Blonde Orthodoxy. Fantastic. Katie, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Southeastern wants you to be equipped to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. That's why we offer our Master of Divinity degree, which provides rigorous biblical and theological training for your current and future ministries. Our Master of Divinity offers broad ministerial training while facilitating a deep engagement with the Bible, all within a textual community that focuses on spiritual formation and ministry preparation. Come be shaped as a Great Commission Christian and experience theological education to the fullest. Visit sebts.edu/mdiv to learn more.
Now it's time for our listener favorite segment entitled On My Bookshelf, the part of the show where our guests share what they're reading right now. So Katie McCoy, what's on your bookshelf?
I've just started reading Practicing the Way by John Mark Comer. It came out in the last couple of weeks. Really excited about it. John Mark Comer is someone who I just can't recommend enough. He is in many ways an antidote to a lot of our very Americanized Christianity and the practice of it. So Practicing the Way by John Mark Comer.
I'm curious as well, if you had to list your favorite book of all time, apart from the Bible, what would it be?
I would have to say Spiritual Depression by Martin Lloyd-Jones.
Interesting. Give me 30 seconds on why.
Yeah, so it's effective. You really could even just retitle it, Managing Emotions in the Christian Life. And he talks a lot in that book about the need for talking to ourselves instead of listening to ourselves, how to understand struggles, trials, spiritual warfare. Sometimes when it feels like we are on a shelf and God is disciplining and preparing and purging us. I think one of my favorite quotes is when the Lord wants to grow our faith, he puts us in a situation precisely when it feels like he's forgotten us. And for anybody who is in ministry, that book will serve you well, because you're going to find some chapter that you identify with and say, this is exactly where I am, or exactly what I fear and struggle with. So wonderful book. It's a classic.
To say the name of that one again.
Spiritual Depression by Martin Lloyd-Jones.
And the John Mark Comer book again?
The John Mark Comer book is Practicing the Way.
Which is fantastic. I haven't read it yet, but I just agreeing with you, I really appreciate Comer's work. In fact, his other little book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, that came out a few years ago, which is a quote from Dallas Willard that Dallas Willard gave to John Ortberg on a phone call. Ortberg called him and said, I'm anxious, what do I do? And Willard said, you need to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life, and then hung up. That was it. And it left Ortberg to himself, and he reflects on that, writes about it. Comer has kind of received that, now a third generation Willard disciple, you might say, and wrote an entire book just explaining how to practice that. And then now this volume from Comer, I'm looking forward to as well. Katie, thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Christ in Culture. If you will, give us a 5-star rating and a review on your podcast platform, and we'll see you next time.